Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 168 and is sponsored by Menla Retreat in Phoenicia, New York.
Mindfulness focuses on the breath, you know, which is the basic thing, and actually can be a very advanced thing also, and it's very good. But actually, reciting a mantra, and in the case of where you're doing it as a personal, you know, private, you know, you're meditating yourself practice, then you murmur it. I had a colleague who passed away, who used to translate that term japa as muttering. Seriously, he used to write, you have to mutter it, mutter. And how to mutter, he sounded like a crazy person muttering. So murmur, I think, is good. You don't make a louder voice like we do in a group chanting. You murmur it so that your mind doesn't scatter with the sound. And it becomes the thing, instead of the breath, the murmuring of like, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, like that. And then that's the thing you bring your mind back to, which your mind wanders away from, rather than just the breath, you know. And what's good about that is that one of the things that draws you away from when you're meditating on the breath, counting to 10, is the inner verbalization, you know, the internal monologue, as it can be called. And when you're saying a mantra, you're bringing speech, and then you're channeling the speech along the line of a mantra. And then particular mantras have particular good qualities, you know, they evoke, like Om Mani Padme Hum, the special Tibetan one, evokes, where do we have an Avalokiteshvara? Oh, I don't see an Avalokiteshvara right nearby me. But behind me is Mrs. Avalokiteshvara, that is Tara, and a green Tara, you know. And Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Swaha, Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Swaha, Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Swaha, Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Swaha. That's her special mantra. That anytime you're about to be run over by a bus or something, you call on that, and then you'll be swift, move out of the way. The bus will swerve, supposedly, I hope, if you have faith. And so that's a good practice, just by the way, you know. That's a very good thing to do, using mantra, you know. And I mean, you can say some English sentence if you want. You don't have to say some Sanskrit thing. Hello, how are you? Are you happy? Good. So here we are back into the Force for Good, which in honor of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's activities, we call it that. In a way more, it's about the sources of the Force for Good. When I had Dan Goldman call me, he told me, well, but what he meant by, in his book that he wrote about the Force for Good, what he meant was the activities that aren't officially seemingly Buddhist, that are initiated by the Dalai Lama, you know, like mindfulness-based stress reduction, you know, calming yourself in a hospital or in a school, which they dissociate from being formally attached to Buddhism, because, you know, they wanted to get past school boards, they want children to have people to have access to that without having to be Buddhist. And actually, of course, you don't have to be Buddhist to practice lots of these things. It's not at all necessary. His Holiness recently, I liked it, made a lovely statement that I really loved, that I hadn't heard him make in just exactly those words, although he's been teaching like that for decades, in relation, I think, especially to some scandal in the European worldwide Sangha, some badly behaving, really nasty Lama behavior. And so he condemned that, His Holiness. And then he said, the Dharma doesn't belong to Buddhism. I like that. and meaning the teaching of reality about what is the nature of reality, which really is what the Dharma is, you know. And in that sense, those of you who have come to other, how many of you have been to other of these Force for Good talks in the past? A small number, but a lot of new people, that's nice. As I often say that, you know, Buddhism, in a way, doesn't really fit for all of its practitioners in the category of a religion. And that's why, in fact, Buddhism in history never tried to stamp out Hinduism in India. It never tried to stamp out Confucianism or Taoism in China. Nowadays in the West, we have Jew Boos. We don't have anybody calling themselves a Chris Boo that I know of, but probably I should be try to be one. I'd have to back up a little bit. And I'd say, I do like Jesus a lot, you know. I'm just not into God that much. He's too grumpy for me, you know. He always was when I was a kid. He would get grumpy and flood the earth, you know, and send Mel Gibson out to make a boat, calling him Noah, you know. It was just all a little too much for me. But I do always love Jesus, although I thought he got a raw deal from his dad, you know. Anyway, so because that's why, because it isn't just a thing that you just believe something and then that's going to save you. You know, the Buddha said that doesn't work. In fact, most acutely, what I think is Shakyamuni Buddha, that is, there are many Buddhas, infinite numbers, but Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical one, I love the paradox of his teaching where he said, oh yeah, I'm a Buddha. I know everything. I'm so happy about it too. But don't believe me just because I said so. He says that. You shouldn't believe me just because, and oh, Buddha's so cute, I like him. Whatever he said, I must believe that. No, he said. Some cuter person will come and tell you a bunch of baloney. Well, they won't know what they're talking about. So don't believe something just because somebody said it. You have to test it out, you have to investigate it, you have to try it out in your mind, some particular path or something. And then if you begin to get a good result, and if it makes sense to you, then you start giving somebody, a teacher, like credibility, but not just believing because they have some sort of pedigree or they're called Lama so-and-so or Roshi such-and-such or whatever it is, or Professor such-and-such. You don't believe it, you know. So again, that's not the usual religious thing, right? All right? The religious thing is you have to believe. Even the Four Noble Truths, the famous framework thing that Buddha taught in the beginning of his teaching, Shakyamuni, it was translated in English as Four Noble Truths, and Denbashi in Tibetan, Satya, Chatvarya Satyani in Sanskrit. And that can mean truth, but it can also mean a fact or a reality. So you could also translate that as the Four Noble Facts, which would sort of de-religionize it, you know, they can be facts. Because actually what it is in the pattern of a therapeutic or medical diagnosis. First one is the fact of suffering. So, I mean, believe in suffering. Nobody's saying that. We don't have to believe in it. Just stub your toe and then you know about it. And it's just acknowledging. And also, it isn't poor Pope Benedict. He thought Buddhists were all miserable. And he was very unhappy. How could anybody be so miserable as to think that everything is suffering, he said. He wrote it in John Paul's book, actually, and he said it himself many times. And because he mistook, you know, the unenlightened life is going to be suffering. You know, a life driven by delusion will be suffering, is actually what he said. Remember Socrates' famous statement? It's more drastic than Buddha's statement. He said, the unexamined life is not worth living, he said. Buddha never said the unenlightened life is not worth living. He just said it'll be frustrating, you know, and don't try to gloss it over. And, you know, as long as you insist, and of course he only said that because you don't have to be unenlightened. You know, if everybody's automatically had to be unenlightened forever, then as the Dalai Lama once said, I think, I don't know if he made that gesture, I remember it that way, but he didn't say that. But he said, if there was no way out of the suffering, and Buddha comes and announces that that life is suffering, he's just going like, nya, nya. It's like going up to someone who's life in prison and saying, oh, you'll never get out of there, nya, nya. But that's so silly. Buddha said, the unenlightened life is suffering, and actually the enlightened life is blissful. It's nirvana, it's fine. The real, and that's the real life. That's the life we really deserve, we really have. That's the reality. That's the higher reality of life. The unenlightened life is not unreal completely, but it's illusory. It's less real, luckily, you see. So it can be, you can trade it in on the enlightened life, and then you can cheer up. And that's the first thing. Then why is that unenlightened life? Why is it unenlightened and why is it suffering? Because we are confused, right? And that's not even, again, a big, it's not to believe something. Who else agrees that you're the main person in the room? Or even that I'm the main person in the room, even though I'm talking, you know, I'm supposed to be the teacher. Nobody. So then, who's correct? Who is the main person in the room? Is anybody? No. So we're all confused, actually. Now, since nobody else thinks I'm the main person, if I'm caught up too strongly in thinking I'm the main person, I'm going to be frustrated. Pay attention to me. What about me? We're seeing this on TV all the time nowadays, aren't we? Somebody who wants to be the main person on the planet. Look at me, you know, right? And oh, there's a few others, of course. I mean, it's not the only one, but it's a particularly egregious one. And brightly colored, I could say. And so we realize that that's completely demented, don't we? But we don't really realize that we're modestly and subtly and also kind of hiddenly demented by thinking that we're the main one. And then we talk to ourselves all the time, like, oh, I'm going to go to the Tibet House and get a lecture. This will help me. I'll learn something. I'll do this. It's an inner monologue like that. I'll get something out of that. You know? Or then in the morning we wake up, what am I going to get out of the day? What about me? You know, like, in any situation, we constantly have an inner thing that goes on like that, which makes us miserable, actually, according to the Buddha. And basically the misperception that you are the most important thing, you're the central thing, and therefore the most important thing. And of course, you can intellectually say, well, yeah, other people are, oh, sure, they're all there. But then, you know, when it's every bodhisattva for himself, when the Titanic is sinking, then it gets like, then the underlying conflict of everyone is the center and no one agrees with anyone else emerges, right, doesn't it? Or in a war zone or in a famine or whatever, right? Although there, of course, always are more enlightened beings who will sacrifice themselves. They will put the other ahead of themselves. And that in itself is enlightenment, right then and there, even if they feel enlightened or not. That's being enlightened, you know, being altruistic, you know. And that's the definition of enlightenment, is being altruistic, actually. Not just somebody with a light bulb in their head, you know, who goes around, like, looking all cute and shining lights and demanding Rolls Royces and, like, special privileges because they're supposedly enlightened. That's really actually usually nonsense, except in a few cases. And usually the enlightened one doesn't try to claim and act enlightened. Although, you know, the Buddha sometimes says there's no such thing as a Buddha, occasionally, like right here, says there's no attainment. In the Heart Sutra, right, there's no attainment. And then he says there's no non-attainment. So, but that's at a high level, so we'll come back to that. So then third noble truth, so you have the acknowledging the symptom of the unenlightened life, looking at the cause of it, which is an exaggeration about the condition of one's being and the nature of other things as well. Then the prognosis is nirvana. And that's pretty nice, isn't it? Why do you think the Indian people liked Buddha and the Chinese people and the every people? Because he said, actually, the reality of you and your life in the world is nirvana, is blowing away this suffering can happen. And particularly human being has a very great opportunity to analyze themselves and realize that they are not the way they assume themselves to be, namely the center and the most important thing, you know. They can figure that out if they investigate themselves. They don't just do it by believing I'm not important, then they would become kind of nihilistic and depressed. They do it by investigating whether they're more important, because everybody is important, of course. But that one is the most important. That's where the exaggeration comes in, right? And then the fourth one is then the method of therapy, the path with its eight branches, which is very, also can be broken down into three things, the three higher educations of ethics, of psychology or psyche, of mind, and of wisdom, which means knowledge of reality. So really the third education is an education in science, actually. So again, not exactly religious, you know. The Buddha's thing is not based on some god telling him, I'm the god and you are my prophet and go tell everybody. In fact, God told him, yeah, I am God, but I don't know everything and I can't fix everything and I don't know what to do. So please teach me and teach the people. That's what God said to Buddha. He whispered to him, actually, that he wasn't really omnipotent and in control. He didn't tell him out there in his throne room, because he said if he did that, then the little god, the lesser gods, the angels would have a freak out because they thought he was daddy, you know, and he was in total charge of everything. It's actually an ancient text, that incident. Okay, so that's a little run through, a little bit about Four Noble Truths, you know. What is Buddhism, you know? So therefore, I met a fun lady just tonight who visited me, who's an Orthodox Jewish, but she loves Buddhism and studies it, and then she wanted to know, like, which thing can I study, is good and bad? And I said, you have your rabbi, that one. But then she was a bit shocked when I said that she was fulfilling Dalai Lama's teaching very well, because Dalai Lama always teaches in cultures that are not Buddhist, and people who are not born Buddhist, he teaches that they should remain in their grandmother's religion, if possible, and but they can learn from Buddhism. And, you know, if they can do something better about their mind, they can be more sensible philosophically, they can be figure out some more reasons to be ethical, which are in their other religion, of course, all those ethical things. But Buddhism has a really great scientific psychology and biology and other things that you can fit in. You sort of fit into whatever cultural matrix you and grandma are in together. But don't become Buddhist, he says. I'm not trying to convert you. I don't want you to be Buddhist. He always says that. And then if I'm in the room, he'll look over and say, well, there's a few people, some people can't help themselves, you know. and then I reassure him that I was really a secularist. But then that's no good. That doesn't reassure him even, because he considers secular humanism to be like a world religion, because secular humanism is also, in fact, based on blind faith, in case you didn't know that. You know, the faith that you won't exist after you die is unevidenced. There's no evidence for that. It's just a blind faith assertion. In case you believe that, you should re-examine, actually, as to the source. Did Einstein discover the nothing that people are supposed to enter after they die? You think? You think he discovered it? Is anybody going to ever discover nothing? In fact, to me, that's the most important foundation of beginning to live a more enlightened life, is to realize that you're going to keep on living life forever. That's really important. And I mean, it agrees with most religions, actually. But are you going to live through your children, maybe, or live through the monument you build, you know, or the patents that you hold, or whatever, the Nobel Prize that you win, but that you're going to live forever. There was a movie on that premise, though. Did you ever see it? It was called Death Becomes Her, and they were wandered into Hollywood into some house, and there was some like Egyptian-looking thing, very Hollywood, you know, and then there was a elixir in a flask, and of course they greedily gobbled it down, and then they couldn't die. But they could have accidents and be injured and like be in the most horrible condition, but they couldn't die. And pretty soon they were like looking to how to undrink that elixir, you know, when they were like all like this, you know, all broken. That's a fun movie, actually. I really liked it. I haven't seen it. I don't know how good it really is, but it was a good topic. Okay.
This episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast is a part of the ongoing series Force for Good. To watch more free teachings from the Force for Good series, please visit Tibet House US on YouTube and visit tibethouse.us to learn about the next Force for Good class series with Robert Thurman and friends. This episode's proud sponsor is Menla Retreat. Menla offers year-round personal wellness getaways, which include private accommodations, delicious healthy cuisine, daily meditation, access to the world-class Dewa Healing Spa, as well as gorgeous hikes around the enchanting Catskill Mountains. To learn more, visit menla.us.
Okay, now I said that in this beginning part of the course this semester, the main text is this one that I like a lot called the Sublime Continuum, and its explanatory commentary, which is a translation of the Mahayana Uttara Tantra Shastra Vyakhya in Sanskrit, which means what it says. But the word tantra really means continuum. It's not a tantric or esoteric text. It's an exoteric text, and the word tantra means continuum. That's all. That's why the word tantra is there. It may have some relationship to Buddhist tantra, in fact, but it's not overtly at least teaching anything about tantra. And this has an interesting story. Do you know the story of Arya Asanga or Asanga, the great Indian? He was a contemporary of Augustine in the West, and he was a great scholar and a sage and a saint. He became a saint and teacher and writer, you know, like one of the great, what the Dalai Lama considers another Buddha of a later generation in the lineage from Buddha. In India, around 400, he lived, 4th century. And although dates are not exact because Indian dating is very difficult. So he was a well-known teacher in Buddhism and meditator, and he was a kind of adept and highly respected. But he was very dissatisfied with the condition of the Sangha, the community, the institution in India at his time, about 900 years, 800 years after Buddha's time. And he thought, well, everything is already decaying and degenerating, and people are not really putting things into practice, and they're not understanding it enough, and et cetera, et cetera. So maybe I'm going to go and make a special retreat, and I'm going to meet the next Buddha, Maitreya, because Buddhists think that when Buddhas come to a planet, they first hang out in a certain heaven near the planet, not the heaven, because there are many heavens, actually, they believe, but a particular one. And in that heaven, they have a kind of dharma center, very good infrastructure. The gods in the heaven don't necessarily go to the dharma center because they're all goofing off, you know, having fun and partying, you know, which is why it's better to be human than divine, because the gods just too much, you know, they have 10,000-year jacuzzis and things like that. So they don't really want to study or meditate in their jacuzzi. Just into sort of pleasure, which ultimately is short-lived at the end of it, even though it's long terms in our terms, time terms. And he said, and the Dharma Center there, though, they are really a lot of the great, there's a tradition in Buddhism, a lot of the great practitioners and scholars and sages, they love to go there with the future Buddha, and then they have more discussions, you know, and dialogues and analysis of the world, you know. And so he said, I want to invite him to come and manifest, because such a high-level being can manifest embodiments in other places according to Buddhist belief. So he goes to a cave and he meditates on Maitreya, and he basically is calling Maitreya, where are you? You know, like he wants a vision like this, and then he wants to ask Maitreya, what can we do to kind of revive Buddhism? You know, that's his motive, you know, and because he's already a teacher. And he meditates and meditates, meditates for 3 years, and then he doesn't have a vision of Maitreya, and gets disgusted, and starts to leave. And as he's going down the mountain, there's an old man. I mean, you all know this story. I won't tell. It's a shaggy dog story, literally. But okay, if you don't know, I'll tell you. It's a nice one. And he goes down, and there's a man who is sitting on a he has a lump of iron, like a little iron rod, like a little short one like that. And he has a cloth, and he's rubbing, like shoe shining, rubbing the lump of iron. And so as the Sangha's curiosity is piqued by that as he's going by, even though he's very despaired, and he says, "What are you doing, rubbing that iron piece of metal with a cloth?" And the guy says, "I'm making a needle." And then he says, "Well, you can't make a needle rubbing a piece of iron with a cloth." He says, "Oh, really?" The guy says, and he holds up a little dish, and he has like 2 dozen needles. So he says, "Oh, okay, I get the message." He goes back to meditate. Besides, he hasn't put enough into it, you know. So then he's meditating. Then 2 more times he leaves like that, after each time, after 3 years. The second time he sees, water dripping on a rock, and it's made a big bowl in the rock on top of which it drips, you know, down the mountain. You know, there's a huge bowl there. So he says, "Okay, drops of water eroding the rock. I'll go back again." And then the last time he sees bird making a nest on a ledge, and where it comes in for a landing with the twig that is making the nest, the wing brushes the rock and it's cut into the rock. Generations of birds making it with their wing, you know, just grazing the rock with the feather. So he says, "Okay, I went back." So he 12 years. So then after 12 years, he's like, "Forget it. I don't care what I see. I'm not going back. Maitreya is like on vacation or something, or like, or I'm too impure, or whatever it is, and I just forget." He just completely despaired and given up, dark night of the soul sort of thing. So he comes to the outskirts of a town. He doesn't really know where he's going. He thinks maybe he'll go somewhere and be a sweeper or something. And he sees a dog, a female dog, and who is coming like this, you know. And then that dog has like maggots in its flesh, you know, it's like all wounded and scabrous, and there's actually crawling maggots in its flesh, and it's really in a bad way. And he just becomes obsessed with looking at it, and like, this is terrible. Like, okay, well, all right, I can't see Maitreya, but what can I do about this dog? It's in really bad state. So then he sort of goes over to some trickling little polluted stream or something, and he thinks, "I can wash it off, you know, and then maybe we go into town and find some medicine or something, whatever." And then he starts to do that, and then he notices the maggots. And the maggots are hopping around. They're kind of having fun there. Like, little maggots slipping around. Well, if I just scrape them off, they're going to die in the dust. That's not nice. You know, couldn't see Maitreya, but why should I go killing a bunch of maggots? So he thinks, "Okay, I know what I'll do." He has a brilliant idea. He doesn't go and form an ASPCA. In India in those days, he takes an old shard of pottery or something with a sharp edge and cuts a small sliver of flesh from his thigh, puts it down, gets a dog, and then he's going to get the maggots and put it on the flesh. And then I don't know where he thinks he's going to take the flesh. He's not really calculating too intensively, but temporarily they're going to hop around on the flesh, you know, and they'll figure something out. And then as he gets near to do it, he can't pick them up with his fingers. They're wriggling away, you know, little maggoty things. So he says, "Well, I'll put my tongue on the up there next to the flesh of the dog, the scabrous flesh. Then it'll crawl on my tongue because I'm like more juicy than that dried out dog. And then I'll spit it down on the lump of flesh." So he goes and he's going like, somehow. And it's so funky, he has to close his eyes. And he goes like that. And then suddenly, ping, there's like a sound like that. He sits back and he has he sees like that, like a vision, like it's Maitreya. And, "Oh, my Lord," he's like flips, he starts to bow, you know, in the Buddhist way, but as he's coming up from the very first bow, he's like, "Where have you been all this time?" He starts to complain, you know. "How come you made me wait 12 years? Where have you been? Like, I've been doing nothing but trying to see you for 12 years. So then Maitreya says, "Well, who was making the needles? Who was building the nest? Who was dripping the water? Who do you think? I was with you all the time, but you didn't have, I'm Maitreya. Maitreya means love. And unless you have compassion, you don't recognize love," he said. "So that's why you just saw me now in this form. You know, finally you saw me as this funky dog." And then Asanga's looking very skeptical at this explanation, you know. Doesn't really accept it there, you know, because Buddhists are very critical-minded, even having mystical vision. And so he says, okay, I know you don't really believe me, so I tell you what. Just take me into town and show me off to the people. You're so happy, now you can see Maitreya, you know, revive the Dharma. So he said, okay, great. So he takes it, the thing comes in a little ball like that size of that, puts it on his shoulder, runs into town. And then in town, and he said, behold, the Lord Buddha of the future is here. Everything, we're fine, we're saved, you know. And they're throwing rocks and chasing him out of town. Because they see like a kind of hippie-like looking, scrawny-looking guy, all unkempt, you know, like years of meditating, bleeding leg, and a filthy dog on his shoulder shouting, it's the future Buddha. This is truly Summer of Love, 1967. San Francisco, and so he gets very despaired and discouraged that nobody else can see Maitreya. You know, that means nobody else has the compassion. And but then there's one elderly lady at a charnel ground on the outskirts of town, and she doesn't see the whole Maitreya, but she sees the dog, but she then sees a kind of jeweled foot, you know, like a Buddha foot. Actually, that in the back of the room there is that golden Maitreya statue. And so she saw like a golden foot like that, made of jewel plasma, you know, the Maitreya body. And then Maitreya says, don't despair. And then Maitreya took him up to the Tushita heaven, you know, magically, like took him up there with his special powers that, that such a being has, supposedly. And then typical in Buddhist mystical things like that, mystical stories, he sat him down and he dictated 5 books, writing away. And this is one of them. And this is, in a way, the most advanced one, really, the most beloved one. But they're all beloved, actually. And there are 5 books that he did. And then he came back to Earth with the 5 books, and he promulgated them. And they did cause a big revival in India at that time. And then he wrote commentaries on them as well, you know, because they were somewhat cryptic, you know. So that's the story of this book, okay? It was achieved, it was written by, it was channeled by someone called Asanga from the Tushita heaven. Tushita heaven means the heaven of satisfaction, of full satisfaction, by the future Buddha through Asanga. Okay? And the commentary supposedly is written by Asanga. And it begins, the first chapter is called the Tathagata Essence. Actually, one of its main themes is something called the Tathagata Essence, or the Tathagata nature, which is, Tathagata is a name for Buddha, and it is a name for Buddha that is emphasizing a Buddha's transcendent knowledge of the nature of reality, of the ultimate nature of reality, sort of the transcendent reality. Because even though that transcendent reality is taught in Buddhism as non-dual with the immanent or the ordinary relative reality, nevertheless, in a way, it's transcendent to it. So it's complicated. We'll see. We'll see. It's not that bad, but it is a little complicated. There's a little bit of a paradox in that. But Tathagata means, because gata is like in the mantra that we recited, the sutra, gate, gate, paragate, you know, that means gone, gone, very gone, very totally gone, enlightenment, all hail, is what that mantra means. And so gate is past passive participle of the verb to go, gum, in Sanskrit. So tathagata, and gata in Sanskrit is also very interesting because the verb to go is the verb that is used for understanding words. Notice that in English, our usual understanding word is a non-going word, it's a standing word, understand. And this reveals possibly that in Anglo culture is an authoritarian culture where understanding something is obeying something. I stand under your majesty, or I stand under God, or I stand under high priest. Whatever you say, however you indoctrinate me, I believe that. So I understand. I stand under that. Right? Whereas in Sanskrit, it reflects a culture where understanding changes your world. When you have a new way of seeing the world, or seeing yourself, then you move into a different world. And so you go somewhere, you know, and it's something you actively do. It isn't something that you just obey somebody, you know, and believe in some slogan or some creed, you know. You personally change yourself by experiencing the nature of the world in a different way. And particularly, the most important thing for you to understand in the world, of course, is yourself. Because however you experience yourself, whatever you think you are, you imagine everybody else is the same. That's why paranoid person, you know, who's very kind of paranoid and frightened of others and under, covering up a kind of strong feeling of fear and hostility toward others, perceives others as hostile and paranoid too. You know, they see everyone as looking at them in some bad way and they're frightened of you. So never go rush up and hug a paranoid, because they think you're trying to do a smackdown. Because we project into others the way we feel about ourselves. So if we understand ourselves, we suddenly see others in a different way. They say, you know. That's another interesting point. Okay, so I want to, however, you know, in Buddhist teaching, they always have what they call a root text coming from some, you know, I mean, unless, if you're a Buddha, then you can just talk. And because you're a root text. But if you're just a scholar like me, you know, a poor practitioner and a scholar like me, then you need that root text from someone who was more learned and enlightened, actually. And then you sort of unpack that and you use that as the thread. And they particularly, the way they taught things, they used memorization a lot. And the root texts of the great Nagarjuna or Sangha or others are often, you know, metric, rhythmic verses in a meter, and very elliptical, you know, compressed. You almost can't understand them completely just as they are, but you memorize them. Then you learn in a commentary from a teacher or from a book, a teacher in a book, and you learn what this cryptic verse that you memorized means. And then when you meditate on it, to go deeper than just sort of learning discursively what it means and knowing the expression, when you meditate on it, you have in your memory that the framework, the pattern, the insight pattern. Not that and this has to do with the fact that the verbal formulation cannot capture the insight, of course. It's a doorway for you to enter into the insight, which goes beyond the words. But the words are like a vector into the experience, which always trumps, I can't really use that word nowadays, which always overwhelms the verbalization thing, you know, the slogan or something. Because your experience will be beyond words, you know, which is, I mean, that's not a big mystical thing. You know, you can go get a really beautiful, shiny apple, nice ripe apple. We're in the autumn, we're in the apple season. And you can write a poem about it, you can do a chemical analysis, you can have like painting still lifes of the apple, every kind of angle on the apple. And when you bite into that apple, and it's a delicious, beautiful Fuji apple or whatever, then that's beyond words. That's it. You can't express every element of the joy of eating that apple. It's just, or even if it's a bad apple or something, it can be bad. But whatever it is, the experience is more than any words can convey of anything, actually. And precisely, if people are too rapidly wrapping things in their words, they don't really experience them. They just sort of cover it over with their idea of what they experience, kind of, you know, so they don't really enjoy it. Okay? So the Buddhists are very insightful about all that kind of thing. So, yeah, tathagata essence, that's how I started this. So, and tata means such, or thus. Tata means like that. And such, as you know, means like that. That means it's not quite that, like such as this pillar means something like this pillar, you know? And there's two kinds of ways of expressing sort of ultimate reality. Thatness or thisness, which is sort of the pillar itself, is a reflection of nirvana if you see it, if you have a certain division. Or the pillar itself, what you see, the relational experience you have with the pillar, is eluded by what the pillar really is. So the reality of the pillar transcends your experience of it. And so you can only say such as this pillar. You follow me? And that isn't also a big mystical thing, although it is, in a way it is. Like we are all in a scientific education. You've had a little bit of, we've all had. Some of us more or less than others. And that looked a really one heavily solid concrete pillar with rebar in it and everything. I hope so. Hope it has some steel in it too. And yet we're told that in reality it's made of atoms, and the atoms have just a tiny little nucleus and some electrons, and it's mostly empty space. And it sure doesn't look like that to us. So that's if the atomic nature of the pillar was more ultimate, I think we tend to think that's more real. That's more really real than our superficial perception of it as a solid concrete, right? But and we relate to it as a solid concrete without bothering ourselves that it's something more than that, some inconceivable bunch of atoms making up a solid concrete. And then what its true reality is something even more far out than the atoms. You'd have to go to quantum to figure it out, which, I mean, or to realize that you can't figure it out. But it's supposedly a Tathagata is a person who has understood the ultimate nature as elusive of any relative nature of that pillar, something like that. So that's right. And then the essence of that Tathagata, the Tathagata Garbha, the word Garbha, is an interesting word. And Garbha actually means a womb. But it can also mean an essence, it can also be a fetus, it can have many meanings. And the Tibetan translation is Ningbo, which means essence. But it is a womb. So it's a Buddha womb, you could also say, Tathagata essence. It's a because the womb is the essence of life, right? It's the source of life, isn't it? Of embodiment. So that's what this chapter is about. But it's sort of the beginning of the sublime continuum is what that means. Sublime continuum means the continuum of the soul, the continuum of the super subtle mind. You might have heard that Buddhism doesn't believe in a soul, and that would be wrong. Buddhism doesn't believe in a fixed, identifiably, never changing soul. That's true. Just like the Buddhism doesn't believe in a fixed, never changing nose. And that's why it says no eye, no ear, no nose. But Buddhism doesn't believe that nobody has a nose. It just believes you don't have a fixed, unchanging, absolute nose. And in fact, an illustration of that you can do yourself in a thought experiment, I'll come back to, but just to briefly mention ahead of time that none of us can find our nose. We cannot. We merely want to go like this. But of course, some portion of our finger, depending on how much strongly we're pressing, is touching on a portion of skin on the surface of the conventional nose, relative nose. And that piece of skin could be removed by a surgeon or an accident, and we would still have a nose. And in fact, everything we can do if we touch is not our nose, but somehow we attribute noseness to it, sort of arbitrarily, and like we say, the line here between nose and cheek. Nobody said there's a line exactly somewhere. And on top of that, they would never get away with it because a line has no width, right? So a true line, therefore a line is actually not anywhere. There isn't anywhere because it doesn't have a width. It's not a small rectangle, a very narrow rectangle. And similarly, a point, any point we would touch has no size, so it's really not there, it's an abstraction. So you can do a thought experience like that, go down to atoms and subatomic particles, and your nose will dissolve under analysis. Which if you really do that thought experiment with strong concentration many, many times, everybody's picking their nose now to reassure themselves. But, if you do that with a really strong, when you just do it like a verbal sequence like that, well, okay, great, fine, playing with words, you say. But if you do that and then it really develops deeply and meditatively, then it becomes a deep experience, like Einstein, one of Einstein's thought experiments, and it will actually change the way that your nose stands out there on your face. It makes you more relaxed about your nose, especially as you grow older and the nose begins a little bit sag, or if you're a heavy drinker and it begins to like shine like Rudolph with a little red thing, like shiny nose, serious heavy drinker, And then you don't mind because it's a process, in other words. We arbitrarily define that's the nose, but it's a constructed process. It isn't like it's there as a thing in itself, is the key point. And that's a deep point, actually. It's when you concentrate on it, everything is like that, including a Buddha, actually, even. He bow down to all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. They always do that. The body of the whole treatise is condensed into these seven Vajra topics. I'll go back to the different words. The Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The element, which is another expression for the essence. The element, that means the Tathagata element or Tathagata essence. Buddha nature, that's the same thing as what people have more widely heard of called Buddha nature. The enlightenment, the excellences, and last, the enlightened activities of a Buddha. So under these seven topics, sort of the sublime continuum can be understood. And what is the sublime continuum? I mean, we could just say, just to demystify, sublime continuum means everyone has an infinite continuum. You did not come into existence when you were either conceived or given birth to, or whatever the molecules or the gleam in your parents' eyes, whatever, wherever you want to be located, you did not first begin there. We all have, according to Buddhist biology, since you cannot solve the problem of the beginning of the world, actually, the beginning of the universe is an unsolvable problem, the best thing is to recognize that it is beginningless. It's always been going on. That is the most elegant solution of the chicken and egg problem. It's just always been going on, and it's not a problem, actually. Why do cultures and people, and scientists, even supposed secularists, make a big fuss about their Big Bang, and or Genesis, or all the Genesis types of stories in other cultures? Why? Because the human, delicate, sensitive human being feels insecure in their environment. Something might jump on you and gobble you down, you know, in the old days, or whatever. So somebody might do something to you in that new days. And so they want to feel they're in a world that they can understand and control, and that it will fit with their idea of the world. And then therefore they often run into people who set themselves up as authorities by pretending that they know what's going on. And they say, and then the thing that really secures their authority is that they know where it all came from. So they know the beginning. And if you're sure, and furthermore, we are very scared about infinity or eternity. It's a scary thing. Then there's no ultimate frame of reference. Then anything is possible, given infinity, or if that's the reality of the world. You know, they're constantly saying, oh, there's 200,000 trillion stars. Well, just they only can count that far. It looks dark after that. There's no light coming to them, they say. So they say 200,000. Although it's just an estimate, really, still. But there could be a dark space, you know. Could all be inside a velvet sack in the dark. And then there'd be another 200,000 million somewhere else. It's ridiculous to claim that there's a limit to it. Even the word universe is kind of silly. There's one. One is only meaningful in relation to two or none. You know, one, infinity can't be one because it's no boundary, it's not an entity like that. And we're scared of that. Human beings are scared of the ungraspability and uncontrollability of eternity and infinity, even though it's the normal logical thing. The logical thing is, it's not that important where it all came from. Point is, here it is, and what are we going to do about it, you know, is the main thing, you know. And then it turns out that beginninglessness has positive side effects. You know, in a way, it's just a negation. So it's just saying that such things that people put forward in history, like the uncaused cause, something coming out of nothing. Where would there ever be evidence of such a thing? They're just assertions. Somebody says, oh yeah, oh, that makes sense. It couldn't go on forever, so it must be uncaused cause. Who says it couldn't go on forever? Who said? On what basis? Did they go somewhere forever and then decide that something else couldn't go on that far? It's ridiculous. It's just an irrational, blind assertion to make you feel comfortable and under control. And actually, Buddha was very well aware of it. Therefore, Buddha, one thing he did, he never wrote anything once he was a Buddha, they say, but he drew a wheel on the ground in the sand, in illustrating what he was talking about. And this was a wheel called the Wheel of Dependent Origination, Tenzin Derwa Junwa, you know. And then it has the different life forms and things like that. But it isn't like there's a beginning to a wheel. A wheel always goes round and round and round, you know. It doesn't have a point in the wheel that you start the wheel. It's just always there. But in a way, he sort of satisfied the longing for knowledge of the beginning in a very tricky way, actually. He said, the world begins for anyone in it from ignorance, from their failure to know that it doesn't begin, that it's beginning less, which doesn't mean they don't exist. It just means that if they go into investigating their causes, they'll never get to a first cause. And therefore, if they want to say, I only was in this part of it or that, I never was anywhere else, that won't work. If you've had beginning of his previous lives, you've been everything already. There's no limit to what you've been. And therefore, there's a good compassion byproduct there. We've all been related to each other in infinite different permutations. And let's not stress on the bad ones, you know, where we had terrible fights and problems or gobbled each other down as a dinosaur and a vegetable or whatever. Let's think of the good ones where we were each other's moms. That's what the Buddhists like to focus on. Because in ordinary self-centered and enlightened biology, the most altruistic moment that beings have is had by the females of the beings, where they give their own body over as a house for another being who, at the time they do it, they have no idea who that is. That could be another Republican from the past thing, or it could be a Russian, or it could be a Klingon, you know, you don't even know. Now they're going to be human once they're in your body and they're going to be working with the material of your and your partner's genes, but you'd have no idea who they were. You know, that Mae West thing, I depend on the kindness of strangers. Every single one of us depended on the kindness of one initial stranger, which was Mom, who was a stranger at first in this life. And luckily, when she has made the big effort of getting us out of there, she's ready to feed us with her own substance. You know, that's because that's the most altruistic thing. Dads are nice, but you know they can't give milk. You know, actually they can. There's a few rare instances on desert islands and things, plane crashes, where this terribly inefficient little thing produced a little bit of like Greek yogurt. You know, tiny bit. You know. There's some rare events like that in human biology. I believe there are cases. You can Google it and see if that's right. I believe I read that. So, but the point is, so it's beginningless. That means we've all been everything, right? Except, in a way, maybe if we're not enlightened, in other words, we don't understand direct experience, the real nature of things, which includes its relative nature and its absolute nature, its ultimate nature, then maybe we did it because we don't lose that once you get it. So therefore, that's one thing we haven't been. So we haven't been a Buddha yet. So but it's our ignorance that keeps driving us, this ignorance. And this ignorance is not just a failure to have counted the number of fish in the ocean, as they say. This ignorance is an active misknowing. It's like, I know I'm Bob Thurman, and Bob Thurman is an unchanging, absolute identity that I have in here. And it's different from everything else in the universe. And so it's me versus the universe. And therefore, I lose, you know. But I try not to admit that to myself. I think I win when I get to be president or something. Ha ha. So that's the dealing with the issue of causation, you know. Okay. So the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And they're called Vajra topics. Now, Vajra has a number of meanings. One is a diamond, one is a thunderbolt. And in a way, in the pre-Buddha Indian culture, Vedist culture of the Vedic Aryan people who were dominant in India, it was not all the Indian people, it was actually a minority that moved in and controlled a larger majority, you know. And interestingly, about 3,000-4,000 years ago, it was the beginning of a racist thing, actually. And the Aryan word was the word Arya was a racist word for lighter-skinned people. It goes back that far, even in India. So those Vedas people, they had an idea that they had a god called Indra, who was like the king of the gods. He was the Zeus, you know, he was the Odin, you know, type father god. And they didn't necessarily think he was the only one, but he was the dominant one. And he had a thunderbolt weapon that was the most powerful thing in the universe. And with that, he would destroy their enemies, and he would, you know, because people see lightning, you know, and it smashes a tree or a house or a person. You know, it's a pretty powerful thing. So it seemed to be them to be the most powerful thing. So it was a symbol of power, and it was a violent symbol, and it was therefore a weapon, the Vajra. And after a long time, it became, and I think by the intervention of the Buddha in that culture, Shakyamuni Buddha, it became, it still represents the strongest power in the Buddhaverse, in the multiverse, universe, whatever you want to call it, in reality. But it ends up being the power of love, actually. And in love in the sense of an infinite energy that can fulfill the needs of all sensitive life. And that's where it then connects to the word diamond. And because diamond is the hardest substance, right? It can cut glass, it can cut anything, right? Diamond can. And it's unbreakable. It can't be broken by other things, relatively speaking, in theory. And therefore, the power of love is like that. And then they have this expression they call, say, the clear light of the void, or the transparency of the void. And so that is that's the equivalent in Western physics, I think, of the strong force of the universe, which holds atoms together, and which you can tell that the physicists don't really exactly know what it is, since it only is described with an Anglo-Saxon word. Doesn't have a Greek name. It's just strong. Once they say strong, then you know they're not sure quite what it is. It's just strong. You know? And then there's dark matter around it, and it couldn't be really holding that atom together except all these invisible things around it, you know. So from Buddha's point of view, they think they do know what is the strong force in the universe, and it is this Vajra force. And it's an impersonal kind of love. I mean, love is defined in Buddhism as the will to the satisfaction and happiness of the beloved. You know, the energy that seeks the happiness and satisfaction of the beloved. So that the universe, the ground of the universe is not nothing, but it's an infinite energy that is accessible to life. It doesn't do anything to life, doesn't create it. It's accessible to it, and it can fulfill any need that any living thing has, is the idea. So that's a very positive. So the Pope needn't have worried. That makes the Buddhists tend to be too complacent and fun-loving and lazy, actually. Since they think that the deepest thing is this clear light. But the clear light is not a bright light. You know, in the 60s, some hippies said this, oh, the white light, man. You know, the white light is a superficial light. This is a gray. It's a light that is not the opposite of the dark. It's beyond the duality of light and dark. And therefore, it's like glass or diamond, it's transparency. Better than clear light, the word transparency is almost a better word. But no word is good enough for it. It's an inconceivability. And we do experience it. Every time you sleep, you experience it. Every time you yawn or you faint, and definitely when you die, you experience it. But you don't experience it in the way where you recognize it. Which we think that we can only experience something we recognize. Whereas actually we experience a lot of things that we don't recognize. And why is it called recognize? That means know it again. It means that we're fitting it into a concept that we already have.
Mm-hmm. Music for the Bob Thurman podcast is provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzing Chogyal, visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. Study Buddhism up close and personal with Robert Thurman and friends on the Tibet House U.S. member trips with Geographic Expeditions. Trips in 2018 include Bhutan and Mongolia. To learn more, visit bobthurman.com. Help the Bob Thurman podcast become self-sustainable and contact us about potential sponsorship opportunities. We'd love to have your support, and we'd love to help you promote your project, group, or teacher. So contact me. I'm Justin Stone Diaz, and I can be reached at justin@menla.org. Tasha Dalek, and thanks for tuning in.